And our last word in business today, it is the loss of a legendary voice.
It's Saturday Night Live!
You probably know that voice, Don Pardo. He introduced audiences to the cast of Saturday Night Live from the very start in 1975.
From Saturday Night News Headquarters, this is Weekend Update with Chevy Chase.
Don Pardo has passed away at the age of 96. He spent 70 of those years with NBC. His career as an announcer there started back in 1944. And that's the Business News on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Kelly McEvers.
And I'm David Green.
For nearly a decade, fans of movie director Robert Rodriguez have been waiting for a sequel to the noir film Sin City. It's the story of corrupt cops and killers in a fictional place called Basin City. It was based on the graphic novels of Frank Miller. The film is black and white with a little bit of color. That style won it the Technical Grand Prize at Cannes. The sequel is called Sin City 2, A Dame to Kill For. It's in 3D and it opens tomorrow.
Sin City's where you go in with your eyes open. Or you don't come out at all.
Sin City's also where you go to get lots of booze, broads, and bullets. Rodriguez makes other films, too. Funny spaghetti westerns, vampire flicks, and four movies in a series called Spy Kids, about a brother-sister duo of super sleuths. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco met up with Rodriguez in Beverly Hills.
Robert Rodriguez has been in and out of Hollywood, putting the finishing touches on and promoting Sin City 2.
It's a very professional town. I mean, people really know what they're doing here, and I learn a lot from them.
But he's quick to tell you that this town is really not for him. With his trademark Stetson cowboy hats and jeans, the hunky 6'2" director is really an Austin, Texas guy.
I love being at home in Texas around my family, and that's kind of where my inspiration comes from.
And it's where Rodriguez started making movies as a boy, growing up the third in a family of 10 kids in San Antonio. With his siblings, he crafted 8mm movies he shot in their backyard, like this 1991 comedy Bedhead, about a girl who gains superhuman powers.
I can bring peace to the Middle East. I'll become the first Mexican-American female president of the United States. But first things first. And the first thing I'm gonna do is get rid of that bedhead.
It has my little sister in it, and my little brother, and it won a bunch of awards, and it's pretty funny. You can see it's a precursor to, like, Spy Kids.
As a student at the University of Texas, Rodriguez drew a comic strip, Los Hooligans, and he made a comedic action movie set on the U.S.-Mexico border. El Mariachi is a story of a traveling musician who's mistaken for a criminal bent on revenge. To finance it, Rodriguez subjected himself to experimental drug trials. He used the $7,000 he was paid to shoot El Mariachi on 16mm. He edited it offline at a local public access cable station at night when no one else was around.
I mean, I literally made it so that nobody would see it. I made it in Spanish to put in the Spanish video market and the action market, and it was called, basically, The Guitar Player. I mean, who's going to rent an action movie called The Guitar Player? It was kind of a joke. I was kind of making a fun joke. I really just wanted to see if I could get it made and see how much I could sell it for.
Columbia Pictures took notice. The studio bought the rights to El Mariachi and asked the then 23-year-old director to remake it as a sort of sequel called Desperado, starring Antonio Banderas and Selma Hayek. But Rodriguez insisted on doing it his way.
I shoot very unusually. I shoot with editing in mind, so I don't shoot correctly. If you got my footage, you'd be going, well, what do I do with this? But I know how I'm going to piece it together, so I would shoot little pieces. And I asked to edit the movie, and I remember Columbia said, you can't really, because no director's ever edited his own movie. It just hadn't been a precedent. That's not how the business was run. Actually, I probably just afraid I didn't even know what I was doing, because I was really, now that I look back, I was like 23. I probably wouldn't have trusted me either.
But Columbia Pictures agreed, and Rodriguez has been doing it all ever since, even making his own movie trailers, posters, and soundtracks.
He's a one-man film industry for Austin.
Rebecca Campbell, the executive director of the Austin Film Society, says Rodriguez has inspired a new generation of filmmakers, especially in Texas.
People have a ton of affection and respect for him. He's always pushing the envelope when it comes to production. He really prides himself on having figured out ways to make movies cheaply, and the importance of making them cheaply is that you can retain your independence.
In Austin, Rodriguez has his own film studio, Troublemaker, located at the defunct Austin Airport. Inside the old hangars are production offices, sound stages, and a huge green screen for filming special effects. It's also where he runs his own Comcast cable TV network for young English-speaking Latinos called El Rey.
It's his own backlot. It's his own studio. It's his own kingdom.
That's another of the director's Austin fans, fellow filmmaker Richard Linklater, whose latest Boyhood is drawing praise of its own. The two have known each other since the early 1990s. They're both independents, and Linklater says they're following the footsteps of an earlier generation of indie filmmakers.
It was very revolutionary when Lucas and Coppola and people like that went up to the Bay Area and did it. I think Roberts set up here in Austin is a new version of that. The industry's totally come to him. I mean, Robert is a visionary.
Rodriguez began shooting in digital 3D in Texas long before it became the trend in Hollywood.
By living in a bubble over there in Texas, making my own studio, you kind of innovate new ways of doing things that maybe people are surprised at the methods sometimes that I'll use. It's kind of when you're out in left field, and George Lucas told me that. He said, it's good you're in Texas. That's why I'm in Marin County. When you're outside of the box like that, you just automatically kind of question everything, and you won't really know how it is done, and you'll sometimes just stumble upon a new way of doing things.
By sometimes relying on the old way, making movies with his family, his ex-wife is his producing partner. One of their sons came up with the idea for The Adventures of Sharkboy and Lavagirl 3D. In fact, his five children were the inspiration for the Spy Kids series. And loyalty is also important to Rodriguez. He resigned from the Directors Guild of America when it refused to give graphic novelist Frank Miller co-directing credit for the Sin City movies.
The system stepped in and said, you can't be directors together because that's not part of the rules. And we went, well, we just have to continue anyway. So you have to sometimes break rules and regulations in order to follow your passion and your heart and something that you know you have a burning desire to do, even if it seems like really bad career advice.
It doesn't seem to have turned out that way. The maverick Robert Rodriguez is already promising Sin City 3. Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
50 years ago this summer, people from all over came to New York to visit the 1964 World's Fair and to get a glimpse of the future. The fair had stuff like jetpacks and new miracles of science like a house made of formica. You could wipe it clean with just a sponge. David Kestenbaum with our Planet Money team looks back at how we saw the future 50 years ago.
I bought an actual guidebook for the fair on eBay, and it's amazing to flip through it today, 50 years later. There are some things that, looking back, are clear misses. We do not, for instance, have any colonies on the moon today. But there are other things where you're like, really? We had that back then? It turns out there was a picture phone at the fair 50 years ago.
Someday, people may want to see as well as talk over the telephone.
In a place where electronic wonders abound, a marriage of sight to the drama of sound.
We tracked down someone who had used that picture phone at the fair 50 years ago, Vito Turso. Today, deputy commissioner for the New York City Department of Sanitation. Back then, he was a boy selling pizza at the fair. The picture phone was one of his favorite exhibits.
To walk into this room and have a conversation through what was like a small television. It was incredible. The lines to use the picture phone were, you know, unending.
So why didn't the picture phone take off? Well, they were really expensive. But there was another reason as well, a reason that explains why we often get the future wrong. Sometimes the idea of the thing is cooler than the actual thing. It turns out people don't always want to see the person they're talking to. We've got picture phones now, but for the most part, people still seem to prefer talking and not seeing. The fair got some things right. Those new color TVs, we really liked those. But it basically missed what was arguably the most futuristic thing that really was going to happen over the next 50 years, the computer and the internet. IBM had an exhibit at the fair, but a lot of it was focused on the Selectric typewriter.
Here's a better way to put words on paper. A remarkable electric typewriter.
Larry Samuel wrote a book about the fair. The IBM exhibit did cover computers, he says, but they seemed boring. Machines for businesses that could add numbers.
I wouldn't say it bombed, but I think it was just people, you just couldn't get it. And they tried to break it down and do little skits and little, you know, puppets and stuff to make it, you know, really easy. But I think it was beyond the reach of most people.
As a kid, which did you think was cooler, the typewriter or the computer?
Oh, definitely the typewriter.
So there were things the fair got right. There were things it missed. And really, one other category. Things where you wonder, why didn't that happen? It seems like such a good idea. Take, for instance, the underwater hotel. This is from a ride at the fair called Futurama, which took you past dioramas of what the future might look like.
A weekend, if you wish, at Hotel Atlantis, in the kingdom of the sea. A holiday of thrills and of adventure.
My colleague Robert Smith looked into this one, and he did find an underwater hotel you can stay at today, the Jules Undersea Lodge in Key Largo, Florida. He talked with Neil Money there.
It's a very unique experience to dive down and spend the night and just live underwater.
The hotel used to be a research facility. It's in the bottom of a lagoon. Inside, there's no stove, just a microwave. But it's got windows.
I'm not sure that it's working at this particular time, but we had a little fish feeder that you could drop some food in inside the habitat, and it would pop out by the window, and the fish would gather around in that feeding time.
Neil Money says he has tried to build a bigger, fancier underwater hotel. The problem has always been finding investors. When the organizers built the World's Fair, they invited the futurists and the diorama makers. They did not invite the bankers. The fair presented this utopian vision of the future, where technology and science would solve all manner of problems. But Larry Samuel, the author, says that even back then, people didn't quite believe it. Outside the grounds, things were happening that made the fair seem pretty naive. JFK had been assassinated just 5 months before the fair opened. There were civil rights protests and the Vietnam War. The economic optimism of the 50s was fading. People went to the fair, he says, because it was a fantasy. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
This weekend, TV's longest-running science fiction program is getting a new hero. Well, sort of. The next season of the British science fiction show Doctor Who premieres Saturday night on BBC America. And it will now star Peter Capaldi. He'll be the 12th incarnation of the Doctor, the show's alien hero. Capaldi is a well-known actor and director in Great Britain. He tells NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans that the show he's now starring in helped him fall in love with acting in the first place.
Fans have waited more than a year to see how Peter Capaldi would play one of TV's most beloved science fiction heroes. They got a clue in this speech, featured in the trailer for his first episode.
I'm the Doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years. I've made many mistakes. And it's about time that I did something about that.
Capaldi has a strong argument for why producers picked a 56-year-old Scottish actor to lead this British TV treasure, replacing an actor young enough to be his son.
I think this show is kind of in my DNA, you know? I think it's sort of part of me. So I think I can recognize when it's right and when it's not right.
Turns out, Capaldi's been a fan of Doctor Who almost since the show started in 1963. When he was a teen, he wrote a fan letter to producers and got an unexpected package in response, containing two scripts from episodes which hadn't even been broadcast yet.
I'd never actually seen this document, this thing that had the dialogue written in it, the stage directions, and this document absolutely blew me away.
For a young, self-described nerd, it was like a sign from above.
And it sort of changed my life. Someone admitted me into the magic circle or probably propelled me into being an actor anyway.
But it would take decades before Capaldi got a shot at playing the Doctor, a time traveler from an alien race known as the Time Lords. That opportunity came from a quirky plot twist producers dreamed up long ago. David Tennant, one of the most popular actors to play the Doctor from 2005 to 2010, explained the move in a BBC documentary.
Any Time Lord, when their body runs out or when their body would otherwise die, can regenerate and have a completely new body and starts again.
In showbiz terms, that means the program can change actors whenever necessary. 31-year-old Matt Smith stepped aside just last year. The change also brings new challenges for the character, as Doctor Who executive producer Stephen Moffat explained to the BBC.
But what is frightening for the Doctor, what is alarming for anyone, if you were told tomorrow morning you will be somebody else, you will be alive but rewritten. That would be frightening. And that's what the doctor faces each time.
When you regenerate, you find yourself with this personality that you have no choice over, which is not necessarily the personality you want.
And Capaldi's take on the doctor's new personality is quite specific.
This character presents himself to those around him in a certain way, but in fact there's a completely unknown doctor that is rarely revealed to those around him, because that other doctor probably exists in a whole other plane and has a relationship with the universe that's probably beyond the ken of human beings.
This also makes Capaldi's doctor seem a little darker and more impatient than previous versions, perfect for an age when even comic book champions are more anti-hero than hero. Capaldi is a veteran talent, an Oscar-winning short film director whose past TV roles include the classic British comedy The Thick of It. But a bit of the old fanboy enthusiasm creeps into his voice when he explains why audiences still love the Doctor, who scoops up human companions for adventure in a time machine disguised as a police call box.
He kind of opens a door in this world. And if you go through that door, you can be taken anywhere in time and space. But you'll always be returned back to, like, your backyard or your hometown.
So far, it looks like Capaldi's past makes him the perfect caretaker for the Doctor's future. I'm Eric Deggans.